Let's go out to the ball game, boys.
Why yeah, that's good idea. Idea. Why ask me that at all?
Yes, here we go. We're gone.
Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here.
George Castle, welcome to the bookshelf.
Well, thank you. I really, really appreciate it. And any author loves any type of interview. We do the interviews ourselves, but when we get interviewed, we fall on our hands and knees. We really do.
Okay, so let's start right off with the title of the game. When the Game Changed, an Oral History of Baseball's True Golden Age, 1969 to 1979. So my question is, can there really be just one golden age?
There are a number of golden ages, but I think a lot of the stereotypes have put the golden age as either in the 20s because of Babe Ruth or the 50s, and that's centered around Mickey, Willie, and the Duke in New York. It's centered around a lot of New York authors and New York pundits' memories of the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees, with the New York Giants kind of tagging along for the ride. But I really think that the most number of Hall of Famers at the same time played in the late 60s through the end of the 1970s. You had a lot of the African-American players who began in the 50s. They were still active, the Henry Aarons, Willie Mays, Frank Robinsons. And then you had a new crop of Hall of Famers, the Tom Seavers, the Nolan Ryans, the Reggie Jacksons, the Mike Schmidts, Steve Carltons. They were all on the field at the same time, and I give you as evidence the 1971 All-Star Game in Detroit. Most famous, Reggie Jackson's rooftop homer hitting that transformer in Tiger Stadium. There were some 20 Hall of Famers on those rosters and 9 eventual Hall of Famers that didn't even make the teams. I'd say that's a pretty good golden age. Now, as far as change, I picked this era because it shaped the way baseball is played now from when it was the structure in which it was formerly played. That is, pitchers went 9 innings. There were 4-man rotations. There wasn't really specialization in the bullpen. There was no free agency. The reserve clause held sway, and salaries were held down. And you did not have true integration in the game. Teams had quotas about how many African American and Latin players they could have. No managers and of color. And of course, if you got hurt as a pitcher, your career was over. There was no transplant special Tommy John surgery to save you. So a lot of what is common in baseball that we think has always been part of the game actually had its origins in this 10 to 11 year period from the late 60s through the end of the 1970s.
And it's funny, at one point you described the that there actually used to be a 10-team league. You're talking about how people nowadays think this is it, this is how it always was. But the 10-team league, you describe it almost as if you're an adult telling a bedtime story to a kid.
Yeah, the 8-team leagues expanded to 10 due to the expansion of baseball, the first wave of expansion, 1961 and 62. So you literally had to win a 10-team league to get into the World Series. You also had the disgrace, if you were truly bad, of finishing 10th in a 10-team league. The Chicago Cubs have been there through everything else that they've been through, and they finished behind expansion teams in 1966 as a 10th place team. So you can't sell tickets if you finish 10th in a 10-team league. I don't know if it's a lot better if you finish 4th in a 4-team division, but it doesn't seem as bad.
It's a psychological thing. Last is last.
Yeah, it's also baseball is a mental game. What Yogi Berra says, it's 150% mental or something like that.
Now, you mentioned all these different things that took place during the era. Well, what would you say was the most important development during that time frame?
I would say free agency. It changed the way the talent was distributed. No longer did you have to wait until you were released or traded until you could move to another team and a player's economic worth was artificially held down by the unique restraint of trade that only existed in baseball. Remember, the players as a whole had this eternal contract reserve clause that would bind the players to a team for life. Even Spencer Tracy or Katharine Hepburn had contracts with MGM that eventually expired, and if MGM didn't want to pick them up, they were a free agent. How baseball got away with this for over the decades, you have to blame Congress for letting them get away with it. No contract is a legal contract when it has no end to it. The reserve clause had no end. Baseball was given the antitrust exemption, and there you go. And this needed to happen. It should have happened for a long time. And Marvin Miller, who had really energized the Players Association, he had to be like a crafty pitcher. He couldn't throw a fastball down the middle to junk the reserve clause. He had to work the corners like a Greg Maddux masterpiece before he finally could knock it down in the middle of the 70s.
Now, this is an oral history, so how is the book constructed? I mean, obviously not all the people who are included in the book giving their thoughts, some of them have passed on. So how is this book constructed?
It's constructed with this basis. I have a premise, a setup, a chapter, which I explain why we like to classify decades the way we do, not just in baseball, but in general. And another chapter that explains the condition baseball was in the 60s. Football was on rushing as a real in sport. It was fast-paced. It was violent. Made for TV on a specific field. Pete Rozelle was a media-friendly, TV-friendly commissioner, and it overtook baseball as a national pastime, and baseball seemed old-fashioned and slow. And so with the year of the pitcher in 1968, Bob Gibson's 1.12 ERA and Carl Yastrzemski winning the American League batting title with just a .301 average, the lords of the game had to juice it up. They had to put more offense in the game to try to keep up with football. And oddly enough, baseball has never caught up. Football passed it, and baseball's been chasing its tail ever since. But they at least reestablished themselves as being relevant, being hip, especially the Carlton Fisk home run in the 75 World Series. That really, really was a jolt, the second jolt that the game got after, of course, the rules changes, the DH coming in to bring in more offense. And basically, the game had to change in order to survive. It's survived, and it's been knocked down a lot through a lot of labor problems, a lot of steroid problems, drug problems. It keeps going, but I don't think baseball would have even been in position to keep going if they hadn't made the changes that they did in the 70s.
Now, let's talk about that a little more. Early on, you write about baseball sins that you just mentioned, the drug usage, whether it was the cocaine trials or other problems, and you compare that with other sports. Why and how media pundits are tougher on baseball than any other sports. Why do you think there's such a double standard when it comes to baseball having to be purer than other sports?
I guess baseball is the game most of us grow up with, they fall in love with originally, and it's most romanticized. It's the most accessible game because until recently, the ticket prices were much less than other sports. You could have a choice of 81 home games to go to, where in football, you've got the 8 or 9 home games, including preseasons. You've got very expensive tickets for 40 home games in pro basketball or the NHL. Baseball was the most family-friendly thing, and a lot of us have memories of just getting up in the morning and just deciding to go out and see a doubleheader on a Sunday and paying only a couple of bucks to do it. So we kind of expect more of that game than the other ones. You kind of think that football with the oversized guys, they're going to start tampering with their bodies and things like that with steroids long before baseball players did. Basketball players you think are coddled. They're allowed to take basket weaving in college if they even go to college. Hockey is not indigenous to the country. There's a few markets, in Chicago being one of them, where I'm based, that have revived lately, but they trail the other sports in terms of popularity. Baseball, according to Bud Selig, was held to a higher standard than everybody else. It's everybody's base sport before, let's say, they become a football fan. And I think a lot of people's knowledge of football is a more superficial than baseball. I think a lot of football fans, while getting involved in the office pool and getting involved in fantasy football, I don't think that they could name the entire starting offensive lines of their teams, nor the primary backups, the way baseball fans can name the 25-man rosters of their favorite teams.
Good point, good point. Is this, you've done several books on baseball, primarily about the Cubs. Is this your first oral history book?
We've had a lot of interviews. My books have been interview heavy. And one more thing about how I've structured this book. I set up my own memories of watching games at the Chicago ballparks or other situations where I was witness to it, and that's how I introduce the oral history of everybody from Hall of Famers down to one of the first women ushers at Wrigley Field. Women weren't allowed to be ushers until the 70s at Wrigley Field, if you can believe that. So, yeah, it's still a man's world, but women were slowly allowed to be on the periphery of baseball starting in the 70s. You know, the very end, they were fighting to get into the press box in the clubhouse as sports writers and as broadcasters. So that's basically how I've set the book up. My oral history or my remembrances frame the meat of the book, which is the personal memories of everybody who participated in the game.